It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check in on the latest in the presidential campaign with Harry Enten.
First, Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton made history by becoming the first woman to cinch the delegate count for a majority party nomination this week. And last night, she referenced the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848, which took place in New York, where she gave her speech.
Clinton has long talked about overcoming barriers to women in politics and public life. Here's a clip from 1969 when she gave a commencement speech to her graduation class.
We're not in the positions yet of leadership and power, but we do have that indispensable element of criticizing and constructive protest.
And here's her concession speech that we were referencing there in 2008.
Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it. Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee.
That was, of course, her speech yesterday accepting the apparent nomination of the Democratic Party. Amid the excitement on Clinton's side, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders still has many supporters who say they'll continue campaigning for him until the Democratic National Convention this summer. Kelly Dittmar joins us now. She's assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, a scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Kelly, how has Hillary Clinton been talking about the significance of being the first woman in this position lately as a major party presidential nominee?
I think as you played, last night's speech really began with putting herself in a historical context. So between references to her own mother being born at the time women won the right to vote, to her point that her victory belongs to generations of men and women who sacrificed to make this moment possible, right? She said that in her speech. So I think that includes the women candidates for president who've come before her, from Victoria Woodhull, who was the first to run in 1872, to Shirley Chisholm, who became the first woman to win votes at a major party convention 100 years later. So all these women really helped to disrupt our expectations of who can be president, even if they faced incredibly long odds themselves. And I think what Clinton did a bit in her speech last night is sort of give a nod to the women who come before her. She's also highlighted the symbolic importance of her bid, especially for young women, putting a note on social media saying, you know, to every little girl that dreams, yes, you can be anything you want, including president. So I think both symbolically and putting herself in historical context, she's talked about the importance of being the first woman presumptive nominee.
Is this different than her campaign back in 2008, which then-Senator Barack Obama eventually won? I remember talk that she was playing down her identity as a woman running for president that time.
Definitely. In 2008, she talked a lot about not running as a woman. So I'm not running as a woman candidate. I'm running to be the most qualified candidate. In this cycle, she's shifted her tune a little bit and talked about gender as one among many merits that she would bring to the presidency. I think being freer than she was in 2008 and probably more true to herself. And she talked specifically about some distinct ways in which her perspective and experience as a woman in a world that is not gender neutral by any means would really be a value added to how she does the job. So I think that she's been embracing her gender identity and her experience as a woman much more this year than she did in 2008.
You'd think with the first major party presidential candidate, a woman in this election, that would be maybe the hottest topic, one of the hottest topics between now and November. Is that going to be crowded out, do you think, by other factors, policy debates, experience, very different resumes for the candidates, establishment versus outsider party politics? Is the issue of her being a woman really going to be front and center here?
I don't know if it'll be front and center, but I do think it's important that we all take this moment now and as well at the convention when she officially becomes the nominee to celebrate the moment in U.S. history, whether or not you like Hillary Clinton as a candidate, to note that this is a really important site for progress. Now, how important it will be in terms of the debates and strategy going forward will sort of depend on how much the candidates themselves make it an issue. So as we talked about, I think Hillary Clinton will mention it. I think she will mention the historical nature of her candidacy. But obviously, even last night, she pivoted very quickly to the contrast on policy issues and really on philosophy of what she wants to see in the country in contrast to Donald Trump. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has accused her of playing the woman card and has really talked about this repeatedly. And so he may actually bring this issue to the forefront, whether his intention is to focus on the historical nature of her candidacy or not. He may actually make it more of an issue than even her campaign would have.
We'll dig a little more into the specifics of a Clinton-Trump campaign here, but I want to ask that idea of cracking and now breaking through this glass ceiling. Does this have powerful symbolic value? Is this something that you think will lead to more women being involved in electoral politics at higher levels?
I think anytime we can sort of disrupt the image of what it looks like to be a politician, and in this case, to be president of the United States, so that women and young women in particular can see themselves in that role, there's a positive effect. That said, there are some potential dangers in some way of having a woman candidate be exposed to some of the sexism or bias that is already out there. In 2008, after Hillary Clinton ran and was subject to some of that bias, we did see some women report in some surveys that it made them think twice about running for office, that this was hard and that in some cases there was some continued gender double standards that women would face when they ran. And so I think there's a little bit of the risk of that always when we put a woman on the national stage and she may be subject to some of that negativity. But I do think the positive message of this campaign and influencing of showing that a woman can and should lead not only the country but lead in her community and at other levels of office is really important to emphasize as we go throughout this campaign.
We're talking about women in politics and Hillary Clinton in the presidential campaign with Kelly Dittmar, political scientist at Rutgers University. I've seen some polling suggesting a really big, I don't know, maybe even unprecedented gender gap when it comes to support for Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. What are you seeing?
Yes. Yeah, so far, I mean, the national polls, as you know, are a little hard to pin down at this point and a little unreliable. But it is useful to look at those polls in comparison to how other candidates have done in previous years and also to the sort of final election count that we saw in 2008, 2012, and years prior. So we have seen a persistent gender gap since 1980, meaning that women are more likely than men to vote for the a Democratic candidate. And so we're seeing that gender gap in matchups between Clinton and Donald Trump. And to some degree, they are either on par with or greater than what we saw for Barack Obama. I think the biggest distinction is that we're seeing Donald Trump do particularly badly in comparison to his Republican predecessors among women voters specifically. So he's polling somewhere in the 30s in recent national polls with women, and no Republican presidential candidate has polled below 40% in the last 20 to 30 years.
How about a generation gap in women's support for Hillary Clinton? A narrative in the primary was older women see the historic value of a female candidate. Maybe that's part of it. They were more likely to support Hillary Clinton. Younger women, not necessarily going for Bernie Sanders and his more progressive vision. How did you see that playing out?
Yeah, I think those generational differences, and I often couch it in terms of the difference between idealism and pragmatism. Always among younger voters, we've seen a real desire for more of an idealistic and even revolutionary view of politics, the wanting to disrupt the status quo. And so that generational difference was really evident in the race between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and it was persistent among both women and men. In other words, young women were just as likely as young men to support Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton. However, young women still were more likely than young men to support Hillary Clinton. So that gender gap we talked about was actually persistent even among a younger generation of voters. I think that beyond the overall philosophy by generation, it's important to note that young women and young men do see the value in electing a woman president and making change and moving towards equality, particularly the Bernie Sanders supporters. But they don't see necessarily the urgency of electing this woman. They believe a woman will be president in their lifetime, and so they're okay with passing up this opportunity if they don't believe that she aligns with their philosophy or political priorities.
As we wrap up, how do you see, you mentioned the way the two candidates, Trump and Clinton, would be running. How much will we see references to the woman card or the man card as we go to November?
You know, I think Donald Trump has been, if you want to say it, playing the man card, you know, very strongly throughout this race. He's really adhered to sort of very traditional norms and expectations of masculinity in this race. And so in some ways, the way in which he's performed gender is even more interesting than the questions we're asking sometimes about Hillary Clinton and her playing the woman card. So I think it's important for us to be talking about gender in relation to both candidates and the ways in which they navigate gender stereotypes that are really still entrenched in presidential politics, and also how they disrupt those so that candidates who run in the future might not have to stick to what is traditionally expected of men or traditionally expected of women.
Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University and a scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics. She talked to us about the historic significance of Hillary Clinton clinching the delegate count for the Democratic nomination.
Right now, it's our weekly political check-in with Harry Enten from 538.com.
Yesterday marked the last of the many Super Tuesdays as the country begins to wrap up the primary season. Voters went to the polls in six states, including the big prize, California.
Democratic hopeful Hillary Clinton clinched the magic number of delegates to become the presumptive nominee for the party. But it looks like Sanders and his supporters aren't going to go down without a fight.
I am pretty good in arithmetic, and I know that the fight in front of us is a very, very steep fight. But we will continue to fight for every vote and every delegate we can get.
And on the Republican side, Republicans aren't entirely sure what to do with their presumptive nominee, Donald Trump, after his comments disparaging the judge in the civil case against the now-defunct Trump University.
Harry Enten's back again to get us up to speed. He's senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, yesterday was sort of seen as the last big fight for presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders to hold his ground against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Now, he did get votes, especially in California, but not enough to win the majority of delegates. And here's his speech after the polls closed in California last night.
We are going to fight hard to win the primary in Washington, D.C. And then we take our fight for social, economic, racial, and environmental justice to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
So that clip, Harry, does not necessarily sound to me like someone who's bowing out or dialing it down. What do you hear in that?
I mean, yeah, he's not dialing it down. He's not bowing out. He's going to meet with the president on Thursday. And then the understanding is that President Obama will appear on Jimmy Fallon and endorse Clinton. When you run and you get north of 40% of the national primary vote, it's very difficult to recognize that, in fact, the other person is going to win. And if you remember back to 2008, Hillary Clinton sounded very much the same as Bernie Sanders did last night. And then a few days later, she endorsed Barack Obama. I'm not sure it's going to happen as quickly right now with Bernie Sanders, but I think there's going to be a recognition by him and by his supporters. We've already seen Jeff Merkley, who was the one senator who endorsed him, say basically the game is up, the jig is up. So it's going to take some time, but eventually, usually, these people come around. There's no way Bernie Sanders wants Donald Trump to be the next president of the United States.
Well, there is word that Sanders is laying off some staff, which has to be some sort of momentous word from him, given that there's not anything more formal. Laying off staff does not portend good things for a campaign.
It tends not to be. I mean, a lot of those staff are field staff, and, you know, Washington, D.C. is the last primary. So, you know, I still think it's possible that he'd lay off that staff and still keep going. But notice, you know, when he says he's going to Philadelphia, he doesn't say he's going to Philadelphia, the convention, as a candidate. It's one thing to go to Philadelphia as a candidate. It's another to go to Philadelphia as someone who's bearing a message and wants that message to be heard. And I think it's probably going to end up more of the latter. But remember, Bernie Sanders hasn't been a member of the Democratic Party. He has been an independent. He feels very little to them. So who really knows if he could very well go into Philadelphia and create a ruckus.
Do you see a contested convention with superdelegates, people switching sides at the convention in July?
And that seems extraordinarily unlikely. In fact, the reason that Hillary Clinton is the presumptive nominee is because she has the vast majority of superdelegates, and not a single one of them has flipped from Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders. After last night, in which Hillary Clinton clinched a majority of pledged delegates, there's no reason for them to do so. The bottom line is that Bernie Sanders is simply put just not going to have the delegates that is necessary in order to be the nominee, and there will not be what he calls a contested convention.
And yet he has been a serious candidate, a very serious one who's galvanized a lot of young voters, some of those who say they're not going to vote for Clinton. They may vote for Trump. They may vote for no one. So how does that get incorporated going forward?
You know, that's the hard part, right? You know, there are actually a lower percentage of voters this time around who say that they won't vote for Clinton, who are Sanders supporters, than Clinton supporters who said they wouldn't vote for Barack Obama in 2008. I think what's very important here is that Clinton, I think, recognizes that, you know, you can't put too much pressure on Sanders. He fought a very good fight. He got north of 40% of the primary vote. Let him come around. Let him recognize what the stakes are in this general election and don't allow it to be forced. And Sanders, once, if he endorses Hillary Clinton, will bring his supporters along with him.
Now, Harry, when we spoke last week, it looked like Clinton was going to win California, but it wasn't a sure thing. There was some doubt about how much momentum Bernie Sanders had and what would happen if she lost. And even if she lost California, it looked likely she would still be the nominee. But what about California? How did she end up winning it?
She ended up winning it in multiple ways. Number one, I think a lot of the polls missed the early vote that she banked. I mean, she was up, you know, she won that early vote by north of 20 percentage points. And an early vote is as good as a latter-day vote. But basically, she did very well among Hispanics, African-Americans, and wealthier white voters, which has been her secret recipe throughout this primary. And I think a lot of the pollsters missed that Hispanic vote in particular, as they had in other states, where they vastly underestimated the percentage of Hispanics that would vote for Hillary Clinton.
So looking ahead, I mean, let's presume that Bernie Sanders does concede and comes somehow into the Clinton camp. How do you broker that transition to someone who is your opponent to someone that you're campaigning with? Do you know anything about the mechanics of how that might actually happen between two people like this?
I mean, what's essentially going to happen is they're going to have a sit down at some point. If you go back to 2008, Dianne Feinstein, who is a senator from California, basically gave her house, her living room over to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. She left the room. The Secret Service left the room and they talked it out. There's going to have to be some sort of face-to-face meeting between the two of them. Maybe it's at the White House with Barack Obama, who's talking with Bernie Sanders right now and who seems to have the ear of Bernie Sanders. And they're going to sit down and they're going to talk out their disagreements. I'm sure Clinton's going to say, look, I'm going to fight for what you guys believe in, and I'm a much better option than Donald Trump. So I think, you know, this is going to happen. I don't know if it happens this week or next week or whenever, but normally there's some sort of sit down and some sort of mutual understanding that they're on the same side of this equation going forward.
We're talking about the presidential race with senior political writer and analyst Harry Enten. He's from 538. And moving to the GOP side of things now. Now, Donald Trump has had a rough couple of weeks following getting called out for maybe not giving veterans groups the money he claimed to. Also for comments that he made against the judge presiding over the civil suit against the now defunct Trump University. We'll get to that in a bit. But last night, after winning several states holding primaries, there was a slightly different version of Donald Trump.
Tonight, we close one chapter in history and we begin another. Our campaign received more primary votes than any GOP campaign in history. No matter who it is, no matter who they are, we receive more votes. This is a great feeling. That's a great feeling. This is not a testament to me, but a testament to all of the people who believed real change, not Obama change, but real change is possible.
The word is, news sites reporting that Donald Trump was using a teleprompter last night, not sounding quite as bombastic. What do you think is happening with the Trump campaign right now?
Boy, he sounded like he was on downers there. That was a different Donald Trump than we're used to. Look, Donald Trump opened his mouth a lot during the primary season and made bombastic statements and won votes. And so he thought going into the general election could do the same thing, but learned over the last few weeks that, in fact, you can't do that. You cannot go after a federal judge and basically say, because he is of Latino heritage or Mexican heritage, that he can't be the judge in your case because you're building a wall. He got a lot of pressure from a lot of Republican leaders, including Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. And I don't know if that type of Donald Trump is going to be successful in the fall, the one that's on downers, because remember, a lot of the reason that people like Trump is because he is energetic, because he's off the cuff, because he's real. And he's going to try and mesh the two of being real without being perhaps too real. Last night, to me, indicated he needs some work at that, but maybe he can put it all together. We'll see. He's proved us wrong before.
Well, we've seen some high-ranking Republicans calling for those who have endorsed Donald Trump to rescind that support. Is that largely symbolic at this point?
I think so. I mean, he is going to be the nominee of that party unless something radical happens, because he has the majority of the pledged delegates. And we learned on the Democratic side this year, having a majority of the pledged delegates is very, very important to convince other people that you, in fact, should be the nominee. And it's possible. I don't dismiss anything this year. But I listen to Ben Ginsburg, who's a longtime Republican lawyer, who basically wrote the rules, and he says Trump is going to be the nominee. It's mostly symbolic, saying, consider to rescind your support. He is that nominee.
So, Harry, just briefly as we wrap up, what are you going to watch for in the next week?
Let's see if Donald Trump doesn't get himself into trouble. That would be something interesting. And I'd also look to see what happens with Hillary Clinton and who endorses her, who previously hasn't.
Harry, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Harry Enten's here every Wednesday to talk about the latest in national politics. He's senior political writer and analyst for 538.com.
Our next guest has been traveling all across the state since receiving a cancer diagnosis in 2011.
She set out to visit and photograph the state's 500-plus historical markers, but one thing led to another, and today her website has more than 20,000 pictures of historical sites, roadside attractions, and museums from around Wisconsin.
And her journey has turned into more than just visiting sites and taking photos. She's looking to share our state's history with the next generation.
Melinda Roberts joins us now. She's a teacher, writer, and historian who's traveled the state over the past 5 years, taking photos of historical markers, monuments, and more. Melinda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob and Veronica, for inviting me.
Now, you received a cancer diagnosis in the year 2011, and that was the kick for you. You decided to start photographing historical markers. Why did you choose historical markers?
Well, I had just moved to Wisconsin in June of 2011, and when I was given my two-year window, my doctor suggested I go do something, since we didn't know how much time I had. So I took a trip to Baraboo to see the Man Mound, and along the way discovered some of the State Historical Society markers. And I decided I would go visit all of them, to learn the history of my new home and to get a chance to travel around.
And Melinda, you mentioned this was 2011. You had this two-year prognosis.
Yeah.
You're talking to us happily in 2016.
Yes.
If I may ask, how has your cancer treatment gone since then?
I was given a cancer-free diagnosis in February of 2015 ahead of schedule because everything has gone so well. And I quite frankly attribute it to the project because
really?
I was so focused on things other than cancer. And I believe that that's what got me through and passed my diagnosis.
And along the way, you learned more about yourself, your own history, including a distant relative who worked on some of these historical sites. What did you learn there?
Well, I had always heard about my Uncle Yelmer Holland, who was writing prolifically about the Norwegians just coming to America before Columbus. So growing up in the 60s, I had to take his books to my classrooms on Columbus Day out in Southern California and proclaim, the insanity of Columbus Day. And never really knew much about him. He died when I was still in elementary school. And I also knew that my grandmother had given me a Bible, a very old Bible she had when I was in high school. And as I was preparing to move here, I just had an impulse to open it, and there was a note from one of her aunts from Wautoma, Wisconsin, and I had never heard about our family being from Wisconsin. So since I've learned that it was my great-grandmother who immigrated here from Norway along with her brother, Hjalmar, and my grandmother and her mother ended up moving out west, and that's how I ended up being born in California. But Uncle Hjalmar stayed here, and he established the Door County Historical Society, which is celebrating its 90th anniversary this year. He was very involved in the Wisconsin Historical Society and the Green Bay Historical Society, and placing markers and participating in research and writing. He wrote the Door County history that was written in the early 1900s, and it was just really interesting to learn that many of the markers I had already photographed had been placed by his efforts.
Wow, so this these markers had this hidden link between you and a relative.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people, I certainly noticed these brown signs put up by the Historical Society around the state. Looking at all of them, as you have, of finding all 500 or so of them, I think was the number. What did you feel a stronger connection to the state you live in?
Oh, absolutely. I begin to believe that I have been brought here for a reason. And there's the State Historical Society marker series is around 550-something right now. But I continued beyond that and have found that many counties have their own fabulous marker systems, Milwaukee, Dane, Waukesha County, Washington County. They all have markers separate from the State Historical Society. And then you'll also find local groups that want to recognize their church. For example, here in Green Bay, we have Union Congregational Church, which has its own marker and talks about how they were part of the Underground Railroad. Markers can be placed by the state, they can be placed by a county or a historical society or a group or even an individual that wants to recognize their own family history at a location in a community.
How did you choose where you were going? Did you get a list and start there, or did you stumble on some places along the way?
Well, initially when I started, the State Historical Society has a document PDF in numerical order, but that's how it's organized numerically. And so it took me about 60 hours to put it into an order by county. And then I went to each county and sort of checked off the markers, and then along the way, I would discover other markers from historical societies or other groups, or I would turn, you know, make a wrong turn, and boom, there's a marker in front of me, or a veterans memorial. And I began to stumble upon a lot of things that were not documented online at all. So my website now has almost over 5,300 markers and sites and about 60,000 photographs of Wisconsin. Not just the markers, but I also try to photograph the beauty, because a lot of them are in absolutely gorgeous locations like Ozitlan and many of the churches that are out in rural communities that are just beautiful. I mean, the whole state is just beautiful. There's markers inside the state parks. There's just markers everywhere.
We're talking to Melinda Roberts of De Pere. A cancer diagnosis 5 years ago launched her on a project to document historical markers around the state of Wisconsin. She shares those photos online. And Melinda, why was the photographing and sharing part of this project such an important part of it for you?
Well, I'm a teacher. I have a background in teaching and teaching college kids. And I had, in order to keep up with them, I had to go online. So I had all my classroom curriculum online so they could access it and not give me excuses about forgetting. And that led me to, learning how to develop websites. So when the marker project started and I was taking a lot of photos, it just seemed like the natural place to put them. I also kind of have an intuitive enjoyment of organizing. And so I thought here would be a good place to organize the markers by county. And then people could go and, you know, they wanted to go into that area, they would know where all the markers are. So my website is the only one that does that, that has everything organized by county. And I'm actually working with the state cartographer right now. We're putting together a map app that people could go to and click on a little dot and it'll pop up and show them a marker and give them instructions on how to go visit.
And is there anything in particular you do with the photography? Are you a photographer already and this became part of what you did, or did you learn about that along the way too?
I've always enjoyed photography. My father loved photography. I honestly wish I had some of his old cameras. You know, they'd be classics now. And so when I had already been taking digital classes and had invested in the camera before I moved to Wisconsin, so this gave me an opportunity to really sort of perfect my art. And I've gone through two cameras, and I'm on a new lens, finally invested in a really nice lens. And I just really enjoy the nature photography and really try to get everything in the best light, literally. So it's just sort of fun. It's been a blessing because a lot of things come through the lens that I didn't even realize I was taking pictures of. And that's fun, too.
I want to visit some of the sites you mentioned and some of the stories you've learned. The Eagle, Old Abe, famous story in Wisconsin. First of all, what kind of markers are out there and what did you learn?
Well, there's a lot of markers to Old Abe. And I think, you know, coming from another state, I've just been so intrigued on the marvelous stories here, the history here that you don't learn when you're not living here. And so Old Abe was an eagle that was captured by a young Native American out in the Chippewa Falls area. And he went to the Civil War with the 8th Wisconsin. And all along the way, the soldiers knew that Old Abe was a female eagle. But they felt that if the Confederates knew that they had brought a female eagle with them, that they would get teased about it. So they hid her gender. And in fact, Chippewa Historical Society has letters from one of the captains where he was collecting Abe's eggs and eating them, and Abe would attack the soldier that was collecting the eggs. So he sent home these letters, and he sent home a feather of Old Abe. And there's other documentation, and there's a historian from Chippewa Falls that has done a lot of research and has absolutely confirmed that Old Abe is female. But nobody wants to give her that credit as being female. She's a female eagle, and she is our most famous veteran. She is the symbol for the 101st Airborne, and everybody says he. So I have this fantasy of going around to all the markers with a gold plaque and correcting the pronoun from he to she. And, you know, as a woman, I find that it's, you know, a little like, come on, let's give her credit. She's a female eagle. And she came home a veteran, a decorated veteran. She was very famous after the war, and I would love to see her given credit as a female.
Yeah, I think you just did it, Melinda. I had not known that until you said it right here. I can't believe the guy who was eating her eggs, the eggs of Old Abe along
the
way.
By the way, he was killed in the war. Not very long after those letters were written.
So much history. Well, we're talking right now with Melinda Roberts about her journeys around the state to document different historical sites, museums, and more. And we'd like to hear from you.
Do you have a favorite historical spot or roadside attraction in Wisconsin? When you visit someplace new in the state, do you make a point to see the local monuments, the local markers? Do you always read those Brown State Historical Society signs? And are you involved in local history projects in your own community? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about one woman's journey around the state to document historical sites, museums, and attractions. And you can join our conversation.
Do you have a favorite historical site or museum or roadside attraction somewhere in the state? Have you visited the world's largest six-pack in La Crosse, visited the Bronze Fonz statue in Milwaukee, or taken in other sites? Do you make a habit of reading the local historical markers? Are you planning to check any out this summer? And are you involved in local history, or do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Melinda Roberts stays with us. And Melinda, we talked about Old Abe, who turns out to have been a girl eagle. Now, you also found out a marker about an Elvis Presley fight scene in Madison. Yeah. Can you tell us that story?
Well, it was not too long before Elvis died that he came to Madison for a concert, and it was in the wee hours of the morning, and he happened upon a robbery at a gas station. It's right there, not all the way towards the Capitol, but as you're coming into town. And he had the limo pull over, and he jumped out, and he was wearing his, you know, his baggy, what he called the bell-bottom pants, and he jumped out, and he came to the rescue of the young man that was being beaten up, and in the end, all of them shook hands and went their merry way, and it left quite an impression. There's newspaper articles that are online, and I did go. And the marker is very, very tiny. They're on a corner, a very busy corner at a auto sales location. But it's actually one of the most popular markers on my website. It's always in the top 10.
You can see pictures of that and other markers, by the way, at wisconsinhistoricalmarkers.blogspot.com. And we'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
I'm enjoying your show immensely and your guest especially. I just wanted to give her some thought because she sounds like this is a continuing project. Wisconsin has a tremendous nautical tradition. I'm a sailor as a hobbyist, and what she might want to consider in adding to her website or just visiting is the outstanding lighthouses that Wisconsin has from Superior to Milwaukee. They are some of the finest and most distinctly historical monuments in the country, and I just wanted to contribute that.
Thank you so much, Jim. Have you included lighthouses and other nautical-themed memorials, Melinda?
Yes, in fact, I've photographed a lot of the lighthouses. I have been to Superior but was not able to get to many of the lighthouses, and that's actually on my to-do list. There's also a series of markers by the Wisconsin Historical Society, a maritime series of markers, which talks about many of the shipwrecks and other maritime history, and I've collected almost all of those, except the ones up there in Superior. Yes, Door County, I believe, has the most lighthouses of any county in the country, if I'm not mistaken, and I have visited all of those, and they are absolutely gorgeous, and I'm jealous of anyone that has a boat that can get onto the water and get to those lighthouses on their own, because many of them require a private vehicle to get to.
Well, thank you so much for that call. And we're going to go next to Linda in Richland Center. Linda, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
So as I was listening, I actually just drove by a historical marker that's close to us, and I thought, oh, I need to call. It's the Boaz Mastodon.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that one?
I have seen that, yes.
It's a mastodon that was found out here, and it's actually in a museum in Madison.
Yes.
In one of the museums there.
She's correct. The mastodon is at the museum on the campus of UW-Madison in their geology museum, mm-hmm. I believe it is. And the mastodon was found after a heavy rainstorm. Some of the bones came up, and a couple of young boys found it. And it has its own state historical society marker, so the state has recognized that as an important location.
Oh, thanks so much, Linda. I'm pretty sure we did an interview about that, didn't we?
And we learned the shocking secret about the Boaz Mastodon, at least the one you can see at the Geology Museum. The secret was, I believe, it's actually made up of two mastodons.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if the historical marker has been updated, but yeah, two different samples, but it's still very impressive to see and an important part of our prehistoric history here in Wisconsin. Another story that you tell, and I know there are a lot of markers in different places, including one covered up by the Monona Terrace Convention Center in Madison, the Black Hawk Trail, markers for the Black Hawk War here in Wisconsin. Can you tell us a little of that story?
Yeah, that is a fascinating story, and I have photographed the one there, and several of them in Mendota. They're all over Madison on the UW-Madison campus. There's a marker. The State Historical Society erected, I believe, 23 markers that follow the trail, starting with the Battle of Wisconsin Heights. And since I live in Green Bay and I was moving west to finish, the further away places I saved for the last, when I finally got to the last marker, the Battle of Bad Axe, I really had no idea what the outcome was because I've never heard of Black Hawk. And I, kind of thought, oh, this must be some little Wisconsin story. And it turned out to be a tragedy and a massacre of over 1,500, mostly older men, women, and children. Black Hawk was don't remember the tribe that he was in, but his tribe had been moved to the other side of the Mississippi River. And he was older, and he didn't want to leave his lands where he grew up. And so he rallied up members of his tribe, and it became a battle. And when it ended in Prairie du Chien, almost everybody was massacred. He did survive, And he was in prison at Fort Crawford for a while. And what really bothered me was that, number one, I've never heard of this story, but yet we hear of the Trail of Tears, and we hear about the Battle of, I just forgot the name of it, where it's a National Historic Landmark.
Wounded Knee,
where about 300 people were massacred. I received a call from a sheriff who's out in the Verona area, who told me that none of the bodies were ever removed from, like, from the Mississippi River. They were just left there to rot, and that cadaver dogs even today go crazy over there. And I thought, why isn't this a national landmark? Why does this massacre receive national attention? And it really broke my heart. And on the marker, Chief Blackhawk was asked, why did you do this? And he said, because I love my land, and I love the history of the land, and he didn't want to give it up. So we look back on these tragic stories as our country was forming, and I think this is a huge tragedy. And I would love to see that location become a national monument with as much dignity and as much compassion as we show to the massacre at Wounded Knee.
And there's more than one Black Hawk marker around the area. I know there's a natural area I go to where there's a Black Hawk marker as well. So it's interesting tracing his steps from the past.
There's, I think I have about 100 different markers for Black Hawk. Like I said, there's a series from the state, but also many private groups have put up markers. So his story, there's even somebody that wrote three huge books on it. They used to do plays about it back in the 50s, and many people have felt very strongly about how this has been ignored historically, especially at a national level, but even at a local level. So it's one of those stories where you think, my goodness, this is just huge, but it's not really well known.
Time for one more caller. Matt is with us in Marquette. Matt, hi.
Hello there. Yeah, I was just curious if you had ever seen the John Muir historical marker on 22 in between Partyville and Montello.
Yes, I have. And then there's also John Muir has a park that I believe he lived on that property for a while. And there's several markers there honoring John Muir. His birthday was this week, I believe. I put a post on my website. We consider him our foster child here in Wisconsin. And there's a John Muir Society in this area as well. So, yes, I have visited that marker. I did complete all 532 of the State Historical Society markers within my goal, and located about a dozen that they had lost track of. And so I was very fortunate that I did get to see every one of the state markers.
So, Melinda, what's next for you? You've done so much already. What's left on the list?
Oh, my goodness. I'm already planning trips now that the weather's nice. Middleton has a lot of markers. I have several. I want to do all the Belgian chapels in Door County, and I do know about several more markers up there. I probably know of about 1,000 markers right now that I haven't visited, but I also enjoy camping in the state park, so I camp and then I go get the markers. Eau Claire, there's a whole series there that I haven't gotten, and there's many, many, many in the Madison area, literally hundreds in the Madison area, and I probably have 200 or 300 left to capture down there.
Well, good luck capturing them all. Melinda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again for inviting me. It's been lovely.
That was writer and historian Melinda Roberts talking about her travels around Wisconsin to photograph the state's historical markers, museums, memorials, and more. I'm imagining she has a lot of fans and local historical societies around the state. You can follow her work at wisconsinhistoricalmarkers.blogspot.com and share your favorite markers. You can still do that on the Central Time Facebook page.
On Monday, WPR's director Mike Crane made his monthly appearance on the Joy Cardine Show, and as always, Mike heard comments and suggestions from listeners, from you.
And one interesting set of suggestions involved programming aimed at millennials. A listener named John said he wants more instructional programs for millennials, and then a listener named Judy agreed. She said that millennials would especially appreciate hearing more instructions on quilting and sewing. So we pulled some of our millennials here. They're not very crafty. We, I guess, take all their time away from crafts. But I have, I mean, I've talked to younger folks who are into these do-it-yourself things. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it can be hard to teach quilting and sewing on the radio,
true,
but I love the idea of it. I'd like a knitting show, but I think that might just confuse me even more when it comes to my knitting.
Yeah, and but there's that stereotype. Do young people do these kind of old-fashioned, crafty things? But then you've got the whole website, what is it, Pinterest?
Right.
Now, all the young folks are there. All of them.
Yeah, so there is Pinterest. But yeah, WPR should maybe check this out. I think this could be something that millennials maybe are interested in learning about on the radio or elsewhere. Well, let us know. Do you agree with that? Do you want do-it-yourself stuff on Wisconsin Public Radio? Tell us.
And do you sew or quilt or do some other craft or do-it-yourself activities that, you know, might surprise people? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.